Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Todd Garcia Bish. He is an environmental educator at Luther Lynn, a Christian-based camp in western Pennsylvania. He was suggested to me by one of my good friends, Paul Tomkiel, who I mentioned in this episode, and who will be a future guest on the show. Paul and I recorded an interview that was subsequently corrupted and need to speak again in order to produce the material that I reference in this conversation with Todd. And though Todd's perspective is one of a Christian environmental educator, what we speak about is a very balanced discussion of faith and reason. And about a third to a half of the conversation is about faith and environmental education. But the other half to two-thirds is about teaching children a love of the environment and about the practical hands-on methods that Todd uses in his role as an instructor to get children and adults involved in learning more about the world around them, regardless of what their background or faith practices might be. We also talk about the role of citizen scientists in helping to catalog and identify bats, birds, insects, and other animals and plants, and how we can be a part of expanding human knowledge just because of our interest in these things. We don't need to be a biologist or an environmental scientist to care and to learn more and to share what we learn. Because of that and my previous interview with Stephen Herod Buhner about the citizen scientist, I'm including a link to the interview with Mr. Buhner in the show notes for you to listen to. I think it complements this conversation very well. And as this show is listener supported, I do need your help to continue doing this good work. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and find out how you can become a recurring monthly or one-time contributor to the show. Every little bit helps. Now then, on to Todd Garcia Bish. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Then, Todd, if you are ready, why don't we begin with a little bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing, and then we can talk about the environmental education programs at Luther Lynn.
Well, if we start at the beginning, I was born in Denora, Pennsylvania. Ends up being rather interesting since that's one of the birthplaces of the Clean Air Act, one of the reasons for the Clean Air Act. I grew up in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. My dad is a Lutheran minister, and we moved to a small town when I was in high school. We lived along the Allegheny River, and then I went to college at Gettysburg College. I was a chemistry major there, and during the summers while I went to college at Gettysburg, I worked at Camp Luther Lynn. It's a camp I went to when I was a kid, and I was a camp counselor for the first couple of summers and a summer program director. And through my experiences at Luther Lynn, and through growing up and my faith becoming my own, I knew that faith was a very important part of my life. And also through experiences here at Luther Lynn, I learned more about what God has created and the environmental movement in general. And I found that that was a very key part of my faith and a very key part of what I felt called to do. So I went back to college for my senior year, finishing a major in chemistry and knowing that that's probably not the direction I wanted to go. Being in the lab was not something I wanted to spend my life doing. So I chose to go on to graduate school. I went to Indiana University in Bloomington for a master's in environmental science. And as I was finishing up that program and had to figure out where I was going from there, I was doing a lot of praying and trying to figure out where I thought God wanted me to go with a degree in environmental science. And one day I happened to be doing some work for a class and came upon an article in a magazine about an environmental education conference in Italy. And one of the key points of the article was that environmental education is really the way we're going to make a difference if we're going to change what's happening in our world and become more sustainable it's through education that we have to start making that change. So I felt that was a real clear sign to me of the direction I needed to go. So from there, I worked at a Lutheran camp in Ohio for about 9 months, teaching environmental education, and then I came back to Lutherland here in Prospect, Pennsylvania for the summer, and it was while I was here that some things came together that allowed me to stay and to become part of a fledgling environmental education program here at Lutherland. And that's where I've been ever since. That was in the fall of 1993 that I started working full-time at Lutherland, teaching environmental education, and I'm still here, still at it, although now I'm the director of the program.
If I followed that correctly then, so care for the environment became a large part of your faith and faith practice?
Yes. Through being at Lutherland, through really thinking about my faith and what God is calling us to do, and the fact that God has created this world and in Genesis has called humans to take care of it, I felt like that was not only something I was called to do, but something I was called to share with other people. I saw it as a place where it was very evident to me the church needed to be working, but also a place where I didn't see a lot of things happening in the church, in the wider church, not just the Lutheran church.
I'd like to delve into some of those ideas, but before we get there, could you define or address what environmental education is and how that manifests in what you're doing?
Environmental education can be a lot of different things to anybody, to a lot of different people have different ideas of what environmental education is. To me, it's teaching others about ecology, about biology, about earth science, but also a key part of it is also teaching people how to respect our environment, how to understand the part that we play in it, how to understand how we affect the environment for other people and for other living things, and how to respond in a positive way to that, how to live our lives in a way that we are not damaging our environment or in a more sustainable way, I think is a key part of environmental education also, which separates it from just science, because there's also a portion of it that deals with lifestyle. Definitely environmental education is more of a holistic, in a lot of aspects, is more holistic. And that's where it is science. You teach science through environmental education, but it can be a whole lot of other kinds of things. More of a, what some people would call a soft science in some aspects. There's a lot of environmental education that can go on through art or through other means that's not specifically teaching about science. That's why in some ways, the environmental education field is hard to pinpoint and say, yes, this is environmental education, because it can be done in many different ways and through many different ways.
And I think it's David Orr who says that all education is environmental education. And I don't know that that helps the conversation.
It does widen it out a great deal.
So you went to Indiana University and got a Master's of Science in environmental science?
Correct.
Yeah, and you've turned that into a program of environmental education.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I could have gone to Indiana University and gotten a degree in environmental education. They offer that there, too. But being a science major in college and science being my focus, because that's the direction I headed, wasn't until later that I felt called into environmental education. But that science background has really helped me, I think, be a better educator, because I've got the background of ecology and environmental chemistry, and I can understand a lot of the scientific stuff that's going on, but through some of the gifts I've been given for communication, I can communicate those to children and adults and bring it down to a way that they can understand.
Which the more that I study education, because as you and I have talked about, I'm in a program with one of your colleagues in Parks, Resources, and Environmental Education at Slippery Rock University. And I'm finding more and more that it's being able to break things down into something that someone can readily understand, allows you to develop the appropriate vocabulary to then have a conversation about these issues
in a way that's meaningful to that student.
Correct. And I think that's another place that environmental education is different than your conventional science education. Once you are done with school, it doesn't matter to the geologist so much if you understand anything about what he's doing and his research into rocks. But environmental education has a very real purpose for making sure that people understand what environmental educators are teaching, because we feel that there's a great need for understanding so that people can make changes. Not too many people are going to make changes because of what they learn about a layer of sandstone, but what we're teaching in environmental education is hopefully going to move people to make changes in the way they're living that will make a more of a positive effect on our environment.
And one of the biggest things that I've found from my studies of environmental education is, because it takes a holistic approach, you have facts and figures, but you also have storytelling. And out of that arrives a need for a care of the place that you live and the world around you. And one of the things, when you were talking about faith earlier, is that I was not raised in a faith tradition that was very concerned about the here and now. It was rather about the kingdom to come after this life. And it's been interesting as I learn more about different practices now that are broader than what I was raised with, about how we can take Genesis and consider it as a calling to be a shepherd over the earth and to care for this place that we were given, because this was the Garden of Eden. This was a gift from God. And now that I'm an adult and I look back on my childhood faith practices, I wonder how different it would have been if I'd had those conversations when I was younger.
Well, and it's very interesting to me that the whole environmental movement within the Christian church is, in most cases, so very new. But there are plenty of writings by Jewish scholars that date back into the Middle Ages or before that deal with creation care and how we live on the earth, and look at Genesis as how God is teaching us about the planet and how we need to take care of it. And it's just something that, it seems to me anyway, that most of the Christian churches have just come around to recently, as we see the degradation of our planet and as we understand how limited resources are now that there are so many of us on the planet. It's a paradigm shift for a lot of us, but it's something that at least some Hebrew scholars have been talking about for centuries.
And we have a friend in common through Paul Tom Keel, who I also interviewed for the show to discuss, because of his path in life, more of the theological side of things. And he mentioned some authors and some readings for me to look into to follow up on some of those ideas. And it's where I wanted to talk with you, was because you have this kind of a dual role as a person of faith who is also an environmental educator. And I'm wondering how that works on the ground when you're at Luther Lynn, how you bring those conversations together, and what it is that you're teaching as an environmental educator.
Well, our philosophy of environmental education here at Luther Lynn involves a few different steps. We want to make students more aware of the world around them. We want to encourage them to go out and explore and get to know where they live, to develop a sense of place. We want to be able to give them knowledge so that they know a little bit more about the creatures that they share the world with. It's amazing to me how, when I'm out hiking with kids, if I can teach them the name of a plant and they can remember it, they are much more likely to care about that plant because they have named it than they are if they don't know what it is. And so giving them some basic knowledge in ecology or in biology is very important to what we do. But the final point that is part of our mission is to try to instill some sort of sense of responsibility. And once you understand where you are and you know a little bit about it, we're hoping that that leads you into caring for that place, caring for our world. And that's the end point of where we're headed. So we do a lot of different things in our environmental education program, to both develop that knowledge, to make students more aware of the world around them, whether that be through their eyes or through their nose or through their ears. But also, we want to bring that back and say, okay, how do you affect this world around you? How do we as humans affect it, and what can we do to reduce that effect so that all of us, humans, animals, plants, can all survive better on this planet? So that's where our program goes. That's the basic mission that we have. For me, as an environmental educator, because we are a Christian camp, a Lutheran camp, we have the niche. You might say that we have a lot of Christian schools that will come to us preferentially over other environmental education centers because they know that we are teaching environmental education from a Christian perspective. And so with a Christian school, we can do a lot of talking about God and how this is God's creation and how does God call us to take care of the world around us. We also work with a lot of public schools, however, and so at that point we are trying to teach them about the world around them. Yes, we are trying to teach them to take care of what God has created, but we're not able to name it as that. But in my perspective, that's not necessarily out of the realm of good possibilities to say, hey, well, you know, I taught them how to take care of God's creation. Maybe they don't know that that's what it is, but maybe that's the point where they will get to at another junction in their life. I can lay the groundwork here. I can plant the seeds, and hopefully somebody else will water those as time goes on.
But when working within the public education system, it's a non-proselytizing presentation of the material?
Correct. Yeah, we don't mention God or God's creation. The closest we get, I suppose, that times when we're teaching about geology and we're looking at a geologic timeline and looking at the Earth being 4.6 billion years old, that causes some students, especially as they get into upper elementary and middle school, to make a connection and say, wow, wait, what did I learn at church? Is that what my family believes? And so at times they'll ask us personal questions about that, and you know, we may have the opportunity to talk one-on-one with a student and say, well, here's what I believe. I believe God created the Earth, and it's 4.6 billion years old. I don't believe that Genesis is a strict 7 days of creation. But whether it is or it isn't, that doesn't change the fact that we're called to take care of it, although we couldn't address that with a public school. But teaching students how to appreciate what's around them and how to take care of it still fulfills our mission, even if we can't talk about the Creator in what we're doing.
I was going to ask you about that timeline of the Earth. Most of my time in Pennsylvania was spent in Lancaster and Dauphin counties, which is near where the Dover School Board case was settled about the teaching of evolution versus creationism.
Correct.
And I was wondering, when you teach environmental education to the private Christian schools, how do you communicate that? Do you have any issue with evolution or the timeline of the Earth?
We do, and so it really requires us to know where each particular school is coming from before we are teaching about geology is primarily the only place that occurs. And the way our program is set up, it's a customized program, so the schools only choose the activities that they want to do when they're here. So if they're afraid of geology or they think we're going to be talking about evolution, they'll not choose that activity. But with the Christian schools, primarily, we don't talk about the history of the Earth as being 4.6 billion years old. We'll teach about geology, about the rock cycle, but not go into the age of things. It does sometimes spur on conversations between the students and their teachers, or between us and the students, about what they do believe about the Earth and how old it is and why we believe what we believe, and are there other beliefs out there, and why do people believe other things about the history of the Earth. So I think it can be a real good learning experience for students, not that we're trying to convert them to how we think the history of the Earth is, but to make them think about why they believe what they believe. My wife is a science teacher at a small Lutheran school, and one of the assignments she gave her 7th or 8th graders recently, they were studying geology, and they were studying the age of the Earth, because even if they don't believe that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. They still need to be able to understand that because they're in their future going to be taking all kinds of standardized tests that are going to be asking them questions about the age of the Earth, and they need to know what the science is behind it, even if they don't believe it. And so it was a very good assignment for them to go home and talk with their family and then to write what they believe about the history of the Earth and why they believe what they believe. And I hope we do a little bit of that here with some of our students when we start talking about geology and the history of the Earth. It maybe spurs some conversations about faith and why we believe what we believe, and maybe causes some to look a little deeper into why they've been taught what they've been taught by their parents or by their church.
It's interesting to me that you're in a place to have those kinds of open conversations. And again, this is just a reflection of my youth, because I was raised in an environment where you didn't question those things, that the Bible was a literal word of God.
Yeah, I like to challenge students or campers when we can actually have a one-on-one conversation about Scripture and about Genesis. I think so much of what we understand about the Scriptures comes from our understanding of our own language. And when we read in Genesis that the earth was created in 6 days, and day to us always means a 24-hour day, but yet when it was written in Aramaic or whatever it was written in, that the understanding of the word may have been different. And to really search and try to find the understanding of that can, I think, be a good tool, not only for learning about this particular issue, but for all of your faith. To not be afraid to question and to delve into that. Now, I can't say that we really have a lot of those conversations. I don't know that a lot of the private Christian schools that we work with would be really comfortable having us having that conversation necessarily here all the time. I'm hoping that I'm spurring a little bit of that conversation so they can think about it themselves and ask questions of their teachers and their pastors and really think about what they believe. But in the grand scheme of things, I mean, to me, it doesn't matter if you believe the Earth is 4.6 billion years old or 6,000 years old. We're still called to take care of it. And that's the main thrust of what we talk about with Christian schools, that we are called to take care of this planet, and we've got a responsibility for everything that's here. We're in charge, for better or worse.
With the Christian environmental movement being relatively young, how is your work being accepted by the community?
It's very much accepted by more of the mainline denominations, the Lutherans, of course, and Presbyterians and Episcopal and Methodists, for the most part. More of the non-denominational or more fundamental sides of the Christian faith are less accepting of the environmental movement, especially their faith and their politics are all wrapped up together. We find a lot of pushback on the issue of global warming from Christian schools. I don't think because they've really learned a whole lot about it, but because politically they've heard a lot about it. So that makes an interesting yet sometimes frustrating teaching moments when you can just see people turn off because they've been told that global warming isn't real. And this is more with adults than with students, but to see people just kind of not listen, just turn off their ears, so to speak, and not listen to you because of what they've been told politically is frustrating. But all the more reason that we need to be teaching what we're teaching.
And it's one of the reasons why I spoke with Paul, was because I know that he has a very broad perspective. And in that conversation, he distinguished between faith versus reason, but not in a way that was incompatible, and that science leads us to the truth that was given to us by God, I believe was one of the lines that he said to me during that conversation. Do you find that that idea is applicable to the work that you're doing as an environmental educator?
Yeah, I definitely would agree with Paul that science is the way that we learn more about this world that God has created. I don't think that there are things that God tried to hide from us or anything like that. But a lot of times as humans, we try to put God in this box that fits with things that we can perceive and things that we can observe, and we forget that God is much bigger than what we can perceive or understand, and that even the concept of time is apart from God. And that whole idea is really hard to wrap your head around, but nonetheless, I mean, that's what it means for God to be God, is to be apart from all those things. So I do find that it impacts what I teach. It's hard for me to talk with a lot of that stuff with students. They're not at the point where they can reason some of those things out yet, but it definitely impacts what I do.
I think this is something that I could explore with you for hours, because it's something that I still have a lot of questions about as I try to understand a maturing adult perspective versus the teachings given to me as a child. But before I do that, because it's so easy, I was thinking about what you said earlier when you're teaching children about stewardship, that by naming a plant for them, it gives them a sense of responsibility and concern for that plant. When you're naming plants, are you using your botanical Latin or just giving common names as a place to start?
I'm giving common names as a place to start. Yeah, because I came from a chemistry background into environmental science and not from a biology background, I don't remember very many of the Latin names. But common names are what kids can remember. And so this is a point that separates some people in environmental education. If you're familiar with Stephen Van Meter and Earth Education, his philosophy is more that you don't need to know the names of everything. You just need to know that everything's connected. But I find that, as I said before, if you can name something, if you know what something is, you're much more likely to take care of it, to appreciate what that plant is or what that animal is and its role as it's interconnected with everything else than you are if you just know that it's a plant and it uses sunlight to make its own food and then it becomes food for something else. If you can actually put a name on something, it's much more important to you. And I think, if I remember correctly, research that has been done has shown that when you name something, it is stored in another part of your brain. So there's a very real physical thing that happens within your brain when you know the name of something. And so as humans, we classify that in a different part of our brain. And I think that's why you need to know those in order to really take care of them, because of where it sits in our brain and how we use what we know.
By naming it, it becomes something that we know. And it becomes a part of our thought process. It's not just, well, that's a plant that I've seen before. It is something that I have an awareness of. It's not an other or something outside to us.
Right. And since we do know the name, then it changes the way we look at it. And it changes the way we feel about it and our likelihood of appreciating it, because we can put a name with it.
With giving something a name, it provides a concern and a care for it. In fostering stewardship for the earth and a care for the earth, what are some other practices that you're engaged in that some of my listeners might be able to use perhaps to get their children or neighbors or someone else interested in this work of care and concern and regenerating the earth?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make sure that kids get outside, to make sure that kids have time to explore and to learn from doing. In the last 14 or 20 years, there's been a movement for kids to be inside a whole lot more because it's safer, because we're afraid of who, you know, might be outside. And that's really been a disservice to our kids. They haven't gotten to explore. They haven't been able to make a lot of connections with the world around them. And unfortunately, if you're not connected with it, you don't appreciate it and you don't learn to take care of it. So the most important thing we can do is give our children the opportunity to be outside for just playing, for maybe some directed study, go into a stream and turning over rocks and trying to catch what's in the water and taking a look at it and looking up the names for what those things are that you find in the stream. That's probably the most popular activity that we do here, is a stream study. We do it with kindergartners, we do it with high school students, and they all love it. And they love the action of being near the water and turning over rocks, of trying to catch creatures, and then of looking at these creatures that many of them have never seen before, and learning about their life stages and their adaptations and how they're actually surviving in a stream, just something that really connects with nearly everybody that does it. So that would be one of the primary things that I would suggest, not just getting outside, but doing some directed study in certain places. It can be a real benefit. Or if you're in your own backyard, learning the names of the trees that are growing around your house. There are lots of simple ID books out there that can help you identify most of the trees that would be growing in your area. And learning them and being able to identify them, again, gives you that name and helps you learn more about them. Once you know that that's a white pine tree, well, when you read something about a white pine tree being one of the most important trees in Pennsylvania 200 years ago, then you have something to connect that with. And it gives you an idea of the history also of that species and what's happened to it. And you come to care for it because you've been able to name it.
That's a really good place to start. And I know that with my own children, there's a local park where they do like a salamander hunt and some other things. And we've been doing that around here in my own yard. For listeners, if you're on the Facebook page for the show, the picture that's in the header of a salamander is one that I took in my backyard, because the different departments of natural resources at least here in the United States, provide a lot of small field guides and stream guides for different plants and animals.
Yep. And now there are lots of apps available. You can have them on your phone or your iPad, and you can take it out with you and can identify them right there. But that brings up something else, that if you're talking about salamanders specifically, there's also a lot of citizen science that can be done in your backyard. Because salamanders and other amphibians are having such a tough time in the last couple of decades, being able to identify them can be very important. There are places to report what kind of species you've seen of amphibians or birds or endangered mammals sometimes. And so in your backyard, you can note what you're seeing, and that can be put together with everybody else's observations to get a picture of what's going on in the world around us, or even in your specific locality. So you can get to know what's there, and then you can use your knowledge to help expand the knowledge of scientists and others that are looking for connections and looking for relationships and trying to figure out what's happening with a lot of these creatures.
And you just reminded me, I get a mailing every year about the bat surveys and the bird surveys. And there was an interview that I did quite a while back now with the herbalist and healer Stephen Herod Buhner about the idea of the citizen scientist, that we don't need to be disconnected or think that we need a biology or a chemistry degree to go out there and be involved and to do these counts and explore the world around us.
Yeah, and they can really generate a lot of very good information. Pennsylvania, just a couple of years ago, finished their breeding bird atlas, and almost all the data was collected by citizen scientists, just noting what kind of birds they've seen in their neighborhood and what they've seen them doing. And they put all that data together, and it has given scientists a great idea of how bird species have changed in Pennsylvania over the last 20 or 30 years, which birds have increased, which birds have decreased. And of course, that leads to the question of why is that? What's going on that some of these species are increasing, but a lot of these species are decreasing? Because birds are a pretty good indicator species for the health of our environment, that helps us look at our forests and our rivers and so forth and take a deeper, closer look to see if there's something we're missing. You know, what's going on that's causing these changes?
And you make me think that it doesn't have to be limited to the rural.
No.
Or these like rustic wilderness places either. I don't know if they're still there, but for the longest time, there was a nesting pair of peregrine falcons on the Rachel Carson building in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is the home of the Department of Environmental Protection for PA. Or if you're in the urban environment or really anywhere, you can be putting out bat houses or bird houses, and those can be activities for parents to involve their children.
Yeah, for sure. And there are a lot more species that are becoming more and more adapted to living in an urban environment. Here in Pittsburgh, we also have peregrine falcons nesting on some of our skyscrapers, and there are deer, you know, probably within the city limits of Pittsburgh, and foxes and all kinds of other animals that you might not expect, but are there. And there are a lot of things that we can do, like you mentioned, to increase that habitat, to create more habitat for those animals, whether it's birdhouses or bat houses or putting a small pond in your backyard. There are lots of different things that people can do that will not only benefit wildlife, but help attract wildlife to where you are so that you get more viewing time. It could be a lot more enjoyable.
That viewing time, for all of my work with observation and permaculture and learning about the natural world, it was interesting to me because we put out winter bird feeders. And though the squirrels get to a lot of it, I'm okay. We used to joke that my son had squirrel friends. When he was young, he would sit in his high chair and look out the window at the squirrels when they would come in and feed. And he would sit there and eat his lunch or breakfast with them. But for me, it's we have mourning doves that come here. And one of the coolest things for me was watching them, because I've seen them around. They've got these gray bodies and everything, but they have these bright orange feet. And it was just one of those little things that was kind of neat to catch. And the other is the cardinal. My favorite bird, what I think is the prettiest bird, is the cardinal, but not the male.
Oh, the female.
The female, I think, is one of the prettiest birds, but I never knew what the female looked like until we started feeding birds. And the males would come in, and I would see this other bird come in that was, you know, the same shape, but this completely different color. And I pull out my Audubon guide, and I look at it, and I'm like, wow, I never knew that.
Well, we have, here in my office, we have a bird feeder right outside the window, and so often the birds will perch on the window right beside my desk as they're waiting their turn at the feeder. And every now and then, I'll make eye contact with a bird, and that takes it to another place, too. We talked about naming something, taking it to a different place in your brain, but connecting eye to eye with another animal takes it, I think, to an even completely different place in your brain to make that kind of connection with an animal.
Another little anecdote from my life that kind of relates to that is I still have a conflict about zoos.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, here in central Pennsylvania, we have Zoo America, which is right next to Hershey Park, and it's nothing but the species from North America. And there are things there that I would not be able to see if it wasn't there to experience, nor would my children necessarily be aware of because of the way that habitat has been changed. So, yeah, there's some serious conflict there to have them there. But my wife had learned from one of the staff members there that there's a display that is just like kind of an open, round display with low walls, and it has roadrunners and quails and burrowing owls and things. And someone had said to my wife that if the park has been calm and there hasn't been people around, when you go into that room, if you're slow entering, the birds will have escaped. And they'll just be in the main area. So the roadrunners will be down on the floor. The burrowing owls will be nesting up on the hinges for the doors and things. And I thought that was really funny. And we were there not too long ago. And my wife's like, shh, let's not disturb the animals. And when we go in, as soon as we go through the door, about 5 feet from us on one of the railings is one of the burrowing owls.
Oh, wow.
And it just looks at us as we all walk in. And yeah, making eye contact with that owl. And then it flew up and was standing on one of the door hinges. And as I walked over to take its picture, it looked at me and it had, I know it's just a personification, an anthropomorphism to think of the owl this way. But it was like it was looking at me disapprovingly for wanting to take its picture. Thinking about that, I don't know that I would have named that owl or know what it was if it wasn't for that experience and wanting to know what it was that was there.
But do you feel that now, if you read an article or see a story about a burrowing owl, is it going to mean more to you than it did before?
Yes. And not only the burrowing owl, but also we got to see vampire bats, of all things.
Ooh.
Which were really cool. There were, I guess, about a dozen of them. And they were out and they had the pool, they had little bowls of blood there. And we're watching them. My son and I were sitting next to it watching them eat. And it was the strangest thing in the world. The thing about it is, and this is where my conflict is with zoos, is that I can watch something incredible through a movie or something. Like I took my daughter to the IMAX presentation of the Flight of the Monarchs.
Yeah.
Which was really interesting to be there in 3D. with my daughter as she's 4 years old and reaching out to try to touch them. But now when we go to one of our local nature centers has an open house, there's a fellow there with monarchs. And when she walks up, she immediately knows what they are, and she can tell that fellow that, you know, they fly to Canada. And then they overwinter in Mexico. And that connection, because there's something that she can interact with. And for me, being in that environment, and it's not like watching it, getting to experience it in person, there's something visceral and very real about it that I can't have otherwise.
Combining your senses and being able to observe with more than just your eyes, it makes a big difference.
I think, Todd, that we've covered everything that I wanted to. I really appreciate your personal story of faith and environmental education. And a big part of it that I took away for me was how we can communicate these ideas to others in a way that is meaningful to our own practices and that others can take into their own. And also the practical ways that parents can engage with their children. And I hope at the same time also get those parents inspired and reconnected with the water world as well. With all that said, do you have any last thoughts or ideas that you would like to share with the listeners?
Well, I hope that at least something of what I've said has struck someone out there, and that perhaps they're more likely to spend a little bit more time outside. One of the, I guess, the side reasons that I do what I do, and especially working with kids, is because a lot of times kids can change their parents' mind on a lot of things. And there's a lot of education that goes on from child to parent. And hopefully I spur some of that occasionally when I'm teaching environmental education. So I hope I've inspired at least one person out there to do a little more, to go somewhere and make some observations. And if so, then it's been a time well spent.
Well, if no one else, you've certainly inspired me to do more. And I thank you for that very much, Todd. Thank you for joining me on this show and sharing your story and message with the world.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And that was Todd Garcia Bish, the Director of Environmental Education at Luther Lynn. And though I've mentioned them before, I'll refer to them again. I point to the works of David Orr and David Sobel, Earth and Mind and Place-Based Education, respectively, for providing some of my perspective on education. So if you're a parent or grandparent or teacher of any kind, I recommend picking up those two books and reading them. They really add a lot to the conversation. Also, Todd mentioned the Pennsylvania Bird Atlas. Check with your state, province, or territory and see if they have any similar materials out there. If you're a permaculture practitioner, there's a lot of great information in there on what you can expect in your area. There are also state heritage programs for many of the states in the United States that provide a lot of information about the geology, plants, animals, and history of an area, and what conservation programs currently exist, what are considered endangered or threatened species. And though the conversation about invasive species is one that varies depending on who you talk to within the permaculture community, those natural heritage documents can also let you know what's considered invasive or what is causing a threat to local and historical species. From here, regarding the show, I continue to record plenty of interviews each week that are adding to the release schedule, and I will be updating that shortly. And for anyone who's interested in the new model for an accessible permaculture design course, please contact me and let me know about your interest so that we can get things rolling there. June 1st is when the classroom for that, and the first of the materials will be mailed out for anyone who registers now. The Traveling Permaculture Library Project is still going, though I need to update the book list of what's currently in the mail. If you have any books that you've received, please let me know when you're ready to mail them on. If you'd like to become a part of this program, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/library for more information. And if anywhere along your journey you have questions, comments, concerns, or there's any way that I can help you, please get in touch. 717-827-6266 is the phone number and the quickest way to get a hold of me. You can email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, and I will get back to you. I just don't always know when. You can also join in the conversations by liking the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or look for updates on Twitter where I am, @permaculturecst. All my best to you, as spring continues to emerge in the northern hemisphere, and as the seasons change to fall for those of you in the southern. I will join you again on Friday, May 16th, for the next Permabyte. Until then, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.